and how that remembrance of harm triggers our stress response to galvanize us to action. When you can know that you're strong enough to manage your own stress response for a few moments, you have so much less of a need to make of anything your enemy. The remembrance triggered by our stories, triggered by our habits, triggered by our lack of a big picture, and triggered by just raw grief, arouse us. You know, we say, that shouldn't have happened, or that wasn't right, or I failed. And by having those thoughts and by having that response, arousal, adrenaline, whatever. And the consequence of adrenaline, or whatever the host of neurochemicals is you want to do something, or you want to protect yourself. And you tend to blame whatever specific event you imagine caused your current arousal, even if that event was 6 years ago. My mother, grandfather, neighbor, friend, me, I'm still harming me now because my body feels all aroused and upset and my mind is all cloudy and I'm full of animus. When you're strong enough, again, this is not, it takes a lot of practice for some people, but when you're strong enough at some level to wrestle in your belly and not have to wrestle with the past, then the need again to demonize goes down. So Rick put up the very simplest of slides from our work. A grievance, the wounding, I only refer to it as a grievance past what would be considered the normal grief time. So I can tell you a story that when I was first promoting this work, I got off a plane in Cleveland. It's like January. You don't want to get off a plane in Cleveland in January. So true, I see the tarmac and it's freezing. I want to get back on the plane and go to San Francisco. But got off the plane in Cleveland. It's like 6 o'clock in the morning. And I'm being met by a reporter from the local paper, the plane dealer. We go into a coffee shop. And the woman says to me, this is when the Stanford Forgiveness Project first was in existence and got a lot of publicity because we were showing, you know, through science that forgiveness impacted health and well-being. So she sits me down and her first question is, well, Fred, if somebody came to you and said a month ago, my child was murdered, what would you tell her about forgiveness? And I'd tell her nothing. You know, I'd say, you got lots of time that's going to pass before forgiveness is on your plate. And I'm just deeply sorry for your wound. And she looked at me and you know, was like, well, isn't forgiveness for everyone? And I said, yeah, but it's not the first response. It's a bit down the road. Because you have to suffer first. I mean, if, you know, again, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, you know, are anger, bargaining, denial, depression, and then acceptance. So, and then she said to me, well, what happens if somebody said, you know, it was 6 years ago that this happened? And I said it would be an entirely different conversation. It would be, I'm sorry for your loss, and if you haven't worked this through in your heart, it's time. And so when I put up the components of creating an interpersonal grievance, this means that it's an active process all the time. But it only becomes problematic after one could assume normal grief. So let me give you a simple, pragmatic understanding of normal grief. Somebody cuts you off in the freeway, okay? Well, this might be normal grief. Just being pragmatic, right? It should last 15 seconds, and then if your body's still there and the rest of the passengers are there, let it go. But those 15 seconds, that's normal. You were almost harmed. So we're not talking about being an emotionless automaton. However, if you then chase after them, pull out your Uzi, and shoot them, that's not normal grief. Or if you tell seven people, you call up yourself, you wouldn't believe the assholes on the road, that's not normal grief either. Okay? The research on serious loss of spouse, usually from death or divorce, is that the normal grief period, whatever normal is vague.
Average,
6 months to 2 years. Okay? So we're talking about relative windows, but I can't talk about forgiveness without letting all of you know that you're going to hurt for your wounds before you let them go. And the denial of pain or the making of an enemy so you don't have to feel your vulnerability, neither of them work. Because true forgiveness emerges in part from your vulnerability, from the strength to be in your vulnerability, to own your responses, and then choose to be kinder. You have to make a choice. So the grievance, as opposed to just grief, is developed when you maintain that your wound is just personal. So it's one thing to say, gee, I had the world's worst ex-wife or ex-husband. And doing the work I do, well, you can't imagine how many bad ex-wives and ex-husbands are out there. It's like I had this image once of this crappy partner factory. That just keeps on getting out these people. It's like, I mean, I could have, you know, I've had rooms of 200 people, everybody there, because some ex was a terror. Okay. So, the grievance, the too personal is just what my ex did. The truth is, people harm each other, make bad choices, are not suitable for marriage, don't know how to be intimate, all over the place. If you only examine what's wrong with your spouse or ex or mother, then you've made it way too personal and miss so much of the truth of your experience. And if let's take an affair. Okay, let's say your partner had an affair which fully eroded the relationship. It's very painful if you wanted the relationship to last. I've had people come and talk to me to say, thank God my husband had an affair because I didn't have the guts to get rid of him. Then it's not a problem. It's a problem when you don't want your husband or wife to be with somebody else. But there's only a few ways to get out of a bad marriage or a relationship you don't want to be in. And if you don't have the skill to talk, then what are you going to do? And I'm not excusing bad behavior. What I'm saying is if you just focus on what the bum did or didn't do, and after time you don't open to, look at this, we have a 50% divorce rate. And people come and go in relationship all the time. And there's only a few ways they go. And this is one of the painful ones. If you stay stuck on your personal storyline and your personal wounding and your own, like, this big view of things, then you create the seeds for unforgiveness to last. That's what you're doing. You're actively creating it. It doesn't emerge simply in the experience. It emerges in the relationship between us and whatever experience we have. Then, whenever we focus on the personal aspect of a wound or offense or a loss, and we don't transition out of that, then we train our nervous system to be agitated every time we review it. Every single time we go back and look at what the bum did, or what my mother, who wasn't a good mother, or what I, who was a completely unskillful person, did, every time we go back and repeat that, or picture it, or hold it, or hear it in our nervous system, if we haven't added a piece of loving kindness to soften it, or we haven't acknowledged our own strength to hold it with some degree of gentleness, then it simply triggers the nervous system to agitate you, drains blood away from the part of your brain that thinks clearly, and you're left with a very limited set of responses. One of the most predominant is blame. They did it. The past did it. I'm no good. That's why I'm suffering now. What you're doing actually then is like blaming someone else or the past for the skillful activation of your own nervous system. That's what you're doing. You are blaming something else for your like God-given ability to protect yourself from legitimate danger. And instead of that, you're creating the grooves in an unforgiving grievance. All that would be fine if we didn't come up with part three, which is, here's the story that I'm going to tell about this experience that focuses primarily on me taking it too personally and how they're at fault. So when we weave a story that we create to explain to ourselves why we can't live a successful life now, why we can't simply be happy and okay with our actual life, we make the peace of how it was a harm to us personally, not a normal unfolding of life, and that I'm not responsible for my neurological experience, nor for the words that come out of my mouth, nor from my own actions, but the offender is responsible. We then create a position where unforgiveness would be the norm. It's the only normal, legitimate response to this kind of wound. When that story gets told a few times, it then becomes a substitute for what actually happened, which is broad and multifaceted and at some level unknown. We don't know their motivation. We can't fully explain all of our failings that caused us to react in certain ways. We can't explain the miscommunication. And then we tend to leave out the active constructions of our own response that helped make this the normal, natural response. And then we start responding to our story, not to what might have actually happened. That active process over time creates in us a web that becomes very difficult to unravel and becomes our unforgiveness. It's, wait, of course it happened to me. and somebody meant to harm me, or I failed, or the world wasn't as kind as it should have been. And of course I'm reacting this way. And you've heard that in yourself, and you've heard that from so many people. Of course I'm reacting this way. It's the only normal way to react to this story. And people can keep that going sometimes for their whole lives. The story being, of course. One of the things that I, like, now to bring you back down from how, like, how you do it. One of the things that has most intrigued me is, like, I've taught forgiveness now for a very long time. And I have seen more horrors than I ever wanted to see in this lifetime. I have heard stories I don't even have words for. You know, I've sat in rooms with a dozen or 20 people only there because somebody shot somebody in their family, or whose entire family was wiped out, you know, in some horror. Or I've sat with families who watched, or not watched, talked to people who were in the World Trade Center when those planes were coming at them, and they were on the phone talking to people that I have spoken to, you know, watching the plane head to the building. I mean, way beyond anything I ever wanted to go within 100 miles of. And yet, through all of that, there's a piece of me that knows that the wounding, that plane hitting and blowing up a loved one, is the beginning of something that also needs to resolve. You know, it needs to resolve. And I look at it almost like the normal curve. You know, you start down here, you come up here, you have your wave of, and then you let it go. And letting it go doesn't mean you forget what happened, because I've had some vicarious traumatizations that I can't forget. But you can forgive. And the simplest understanding of forgiveness that we have been able to develop is a kind of pragmatic, moment-to-moment experience that takes place when you reverse that grievance step. So the three stages or the three possibilities of creating forgiveness are so simple, but they lead to a moment of peace. And therefore, we have been able to teach people throughout this world that if you can just, again, it's related to this strength thing. If you can just anchor somewhere in you a moment of peacefulness, then no matter what story or pain you have held, you become aware in a mind-body way that you physiologically and intrinsically have an alternative. And it comes from three very simple experiences, which are, what is forgiveness? You take the offense less personally. You take responsibility for your own moment-to-moment experience. And you change the story. And the easiest is to take responsibility for your own moment-to-moment experience, which Rick and I have already started to talk about a bit. The easiest, the simplest, is right now, no matter how upset I may be, there are psychophysiologic tools that can reduce my arousal. I can either continue to practice blame, I can continue to practice victimhood. I can continue to develop the habit of hostility or self-pity. Or right this moment, I can try to contain my own mind-body experience and aim for a moment of peace. There are cognitive strategies, which Rick talked about. Many of you have talked about it. This woman over there talked about it. 95% of people don't mean me any harm. They're just doing what they do. Okay? But I just want to remind you as meditators, or most of you, because we're here in a Buddhist place, of the power of using your body and meditation in the moment of arousal to lower your thermostat, to practice that, to not just leave meditation to a practice at the beginning or the end of your day. I hope you see what I'm saying, that when you're upset because you remember what a bum you married, that's the second to take a breath. When you remember, oh, how terrible you behaved, that's the moment. I'm going to do a guided practice on that, but I just want to do one more piece of education is just the difference. I want to make sure you understand the difference between forgiveness and reconciliation and justice and condoning. I just want to make sure. Oh, good. Okay. I just want to make sure that you're clear about that. Forgiveness doesn't mean that you don't remember what happened. I mean, you know, I have dealt with people who have had their children murdered in cold blood. It would be a little bizarre to tell them to forget that. I mean, not just bizarre, I mean bizarre, hard to even conceptualize. But some people think that when they've forgiven something, they're somehow going to forget it. What I will say to you as a very simple reminder is forgiveness allows you to remember it differently, and that's what you're aiming for. You can remember something without the contempt, without the massive self-pity, and without the victim status. But you're not necessarily going to forget it. Now, you can forget, you know, if somebody passed you on the hallway and didn't say hello loudly enough, and you're pissed off for 2 hours, I think you can forget that. You know, if you need my permission, forget that one. But the more tragic, deep-seated woundings, you're never going to forget. The hope is that you remember them differently. Second, a pardon is a kind of legal term. But what I am more interested in, people tell me all the time that if they forgive something, they've condoned it. And obviously, this is a complex subject that I'm reducing as best I can to an hour for you. But what I want to make emphatically clear is, as a human being, until you have transcended this like mortal way of being in your life, which is you are personally identified with absolutely everything, so you're going to take offense. I'm just reminding you, you know, just because you come here and meditate, you've all noticed that you still go out and are mostly the same person you were before you came in. And if you're lucky, you make modest, slow, incremental changes that open you up to a little more kindness, if you're lucky. However, the condoning piece is forgiveness is needed when an action violates your norms or ethics. You don't condone it. You don't say that it's okay. You don't have to change your ethical system to be forgiving. So you don't condone, it's okay that they shot my kid. But you do hold that, like, that offense in your ethical system is wrong. But you are aware of a wider bandwidth as to how you react when people go against your ethical system. That's what changes. What people who are unforgiving have is a very one-dimensional response to violations of their ethical system. X goes in, Y comes out. With practice, you can have X go in, Y, Z, A, B, C come out, and then you choose the more skillful one. But you're not saying that it's okay. I'm just being very clear about forgiveness. You're not necessarily saying that it's okay to have done it. What you're saying is, I didn't think it was right. It harmed me. Now, what do I do to manage my relationship to the experience? Very different. Reconciliation is the challenge. Forgiveness is kind of an inner experience. Reconciliation is the restoration of a relationship or the continuation of a relationship. So you can forgive and not reconcile. And you can reconcile and not forgive. There are plenty of marriages that have reconciled and not forgiven. And there are plenty of marriages where people do that every night. They come home to the same old whatever. So they have reconciled. They've returned from their day with the same animus they had when they started their day. So there is no forgiveness, but there is reconciliation.
Or resignation.
Or resignation.
Either R word is fine, exactly. Forgiveness means, though, your heart's clean. But you can choose not to rejoin a relationship. And this was most poignantly brought out to me many years ago, where a young woman came into a class that I think I was teaching at Santa Clara, and she raised her hand or stood up and said, you know, I want to forgive my father, but I'm scared to go home. And both statements were true. And you can be scared to be with somebody and still forgive them. You have to use your discernment and judgment whether or not you've forgiven. You can stay away from someone because you're angry at them, or you can stay away from someone because you have enough self-regard and positive affection for yourself that you know it's not a safe environment for you. The decision, though, and this is the caution, you make better decisions when you're not angry. And you will make a better decision about reconciliation when you've gone along the ways of forgiveness than you will simply by deciding, because your body gets angry, that you're not safe with them. You may be less safe with you than them, which is what a lot of people have found. And the last piece is justice. You can look to the court system or whatever system you work in to honor your definition of justice. And you can do so again with hostility or mercy. You can do it resentfully and vengefully, or you can do it with kindness. The forgiveness suggests that you do it with as much kindness as you can. And the simplest shorthand I have for that is the hundreds of people in the classes I've taught who have exes who do not pay child support. Hundreds. And they are furious and helpless and feel vulnerable, all legitimate. So I have told them to cleanse their heart of bitterness towards the situation and make sure, to the best of your ability, they pay child support. They're not mutually exclusive. When you can hold this, these distinctions, you see that forgiveness is, in my way of talking now, getting rid of your Grinch heart towards a piece of your life. Like the Grinch had a heart that was two sizes too small to everything. many of us develop hearts that are two sizes too small to some life experience that we've had. And then they shut down and they close up and they tell really hostile or full of self-pity stories to defend why the heart is so closed. What I define or hope that forgiveness is you open the heart up, but you use it wisely. You know, you use it protectively or assertively, but you don't have to keep it shut. And so forgiveness is this place where you actively practice after grief or in the midst of grief when it's gone on long enough to open the heart back up so that you don't have to keep connected to your definition of yourself as somebody victimized by an enemy, either you or another person. And therefore, you don't have to keep your heart closed to your own life, which is what you're doing. And so what I'd like to finish with is just a heart-opening practice so you can see what this might mean, okay? And what I'd like to do is this will take at most 10 minutes, probably a little less. I'd like you to settle into your body. And I'd like you to again start just by breathing into and out of your belly. And again, remember your full belly. That you be willing to inhale deeply and slowly and fully. And that you make it a practice to let your belly expand and get bigger when you inhale. And this is at both a physical and a metaphorical level, that you're willing to be defenseless. That you're willing to be without a piece of armor for a few moments. And then just check in your body if there's any place that you feel particularly tight, and just see if you can breathe into that spot for a moment. And then what I'd like you to do is on the next breath that you inhale, just consciously acknowledge the gift of that breath. This is a very simple gratitude practice. But I'd like you, simply as you inhale, to just access a part of you that right at this moment can quiet enough, even if it's just for a moment, to just say thank you for your life. You know, that this breath comes in and leaves, and comes in and leaves. And each breath, each inhalation catalyzes like hundreds of thousands of chemical reactions that you know as you. And like it just happens one breath at a time. And I'm in the same way that Rick asked you to bring strength through your being, I'm saying, can you bring thank you into your body as you inhale? Can you just inhale, and as your belly fills, can you allow your heart to open? You know, contemplate for a moment just the mystery of all this. You know, that you're allowed this breath for a certain amount of time. That it's not permanent. And the breath allows you to see beauty, to be loved, to give love, cultivate goodness. And then it's just one last piece of this exercise. Just can you hold like the thankfulness or the warmth? Can you just hold it in the area around your heart for a moment? And can you just sit quietly? And just feel your own like goodness? Like gratitude, love, they're just things that point back at you, that remind you of your own openness, heart, warmth, love, goodness. And can you just sit for a moment and just feel what it's like to be you? With just positive emotion, or as much just being positive. Okay, let go of any image that you're holding. Return your attention from the area around your heart to your belly. Take a breath or two and then allow your eyes to open. And I'm just going to finish up this piece by just the simplest, I don't know what the word is, reminder, that our grievances maintain themselves when we lose touch with this part of us. And the active construction of a grievance, of taking it too personally, of blaming everything, of telling crazy-making stories, make sure we stay out of touch with this. We're full of blame for everywhere else and all the past, but we are doing it. We're closing this down. The simplicity of this practice that I just asked you to do was just a reminder that there are alternative states that, again, already know how to forgive. So if you could spend, and I'm not going there now, I'm just saying, if you could spend as much time exploring what this part of you felt about whatever offense you had had, you would find a lot of forgiveness already inside of you available to you. But we spend most of our time exploring what the angry, hurt parts of us tell us, and then we practice these things that reduce our access to this. And so we become impoverished at some level. And you can see this in families and in countries and in marriages. The lack of forgiveness impoverishes us. And so the point that I've been trying to make for this hour is, through a meditation practice or any kind of self-regulation practice, even if it's just gratitude, once you know that no matter how upset you are, in particular if it's not in the midst of that raw grief, once you know that you can find a place of strength or like heartfulness inside of you, then the drama shifts from the past or them to yourself. And you can do a lot with that. There's just very little you can do with the past or other people. And forgiveness is, and this is where I'll finish, is learning to be at peace even when a piece of your life didn't turn out the way you wanted. And you have to cultivate that piece. Thank you.
Before you run out the door, in a few minutes, we will take a lunch break. Fred and I will stay here. I know there wasn't that much chance for questions and discussion, the last little part. I'm sure there's a lot there. Fred will stick around. I'll be here as well. I'd like to make a few announcements and then talk a bit about the whole lunch deal here. On the announcement side, a couple upcoming events. Philip Moffitt, he's a senior teacher here, as well as Jack Kornfield, our very senior teacher here, will be teaching a week from today on Sunday of Vipassana day long. And Philip also, about a month from now, September 26th, will be teaching about power and leadership. So that, again, is one of those hybrid subjects that's rich, where the Dharma comes together with something that doesn't seem initially maybe so Dharmic-like, power and leadership. Also, with Rick Mendias, a neurologist and teaching partner, I'll be teaching on No Self in the Brain on November 7th. I highly invite you to that particular workshop if you've never taken it. It's full of a lot of cool neurological stuff about there is no ghost in the machine, there is no homunculus upstairs, and linking that to some of the most radical teachings of the Buddha, which are on anatta, or not self. That's November 7th. And also on December 13th with James Beres, we'll do a day-long, Rick Mendias and I, with James, on the hard things that open the heart. We will talk about including things like brain injuries, you know, strokes, Alzheimer's, our own or others, and injuries, as well as things like depression, anxiety, ADHD, you know, difficult things, difficult conditions, how to practice with them and how to bring wisdom to them. Okay? Also, I should add that Fred brought some books here, which are great. They're out there. He is the master, so his book, Forgive for Good and Forgive for Love, or either or both, great, are out there. I've also got a CD program through Sounds True if you're interested in it, Meditations to Change Your Brain. Those are 3 hours or plus, 3.5 hours of CDs on both information about how you can light up the circuits of happiness, love, and wisdom in your brain, and then some very specific guided practices to actually do that. And if you're interested in that, it's out there as well. The two together are probably a really good combination for that. In terms of lunch, you're welcome to, obviously, if you might have brought your lunch. If not, the Woodacre Deli is across the street. What you do is you go out to the highway, turn right. You must turn right. Take the very first left, and then the first left after that. Wander down a street, and there's the Woodacre Deli. Very good food. Try to, you know, move along briskly in that process. If you stay here, however you get your food, you're welcome to eat in this hall. Please be a little mindful of the carpet. You're also very welcome to wander around Spirit Rock. Does anyone know if there's a retreat here right now?
Yes.
There is a retreat. So please, no retreat. There is no retreat, Grania says, Mission Control. No retreat. So that's really good. Hey, I want to really encourage you to do something if you want to. It's okay to go past the gate up the road here. If you want, spin the wheel on the way. I always love that part. And then it's okay to look in the residence halls if you've never done that, to see what it might be like for you to sit on retreat here. It's even okay to go up to the large hall up the hill a little bit, which is really beautiful. Please take off your shoes if you go in. And if you can, it's kind of very cool to go into the exact center and kind of look up and get the vibes. One of my favorite things. It's also okay to walk on the trails around here. Be watchful of poison oak. Be watchful of ticks. Also, very rare but occasional rattlesnakes. Okay? We will take an hour for lunch and 3 minutes. So how about coming back at 2 sharp? Ready? Break.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.